and welcome to another Little Atoms Road Trip podcast with me, Neil Denny. Today I've come to Asheville in North Carolina, and earlier I spoke with the writer Dillian Beeland. Dillian Beeland is a freelance writer on science and nature, and the author of an upcoming book, The Secret World of Red Wolves, a true story of North America's other wolf. The book will explore the natural history of red wolves, from their evolutionary origins to their near extinction, and latterly a reintroduction program in a small peninsula in coastal North Carolina. And the book will be released in spring 2003 by the University of North Carolina Press. So I'm sitting with Dillian Beeland. Dillian, thank you very much for talking to Little Atoms today.
Thank you very much.
So we're going to be talking about wolves, and red wolves in particular, and the book that you're in the middle of writing, The Secret World of Red Wolves. So everybody knows wolves, but the wolves most people recognise is a grey wolf. So what's a red wolf?
Right, yeah, that's a really excellent point. So the subtitle of the book, actually, it's The Secret World of Red Wolves, subtitle, The Fight to Save North America's Other Wolf, because most people are more familiar with the grey wolf. The red wolf is a little-known southeastern predator that was probably here in the United States before grey wolves. So that's a little-known fact that, you know, most people aren't aware of. But red wolves, they were basically probably one of the apex predators of the southeast in the United States. And they died out largely at the time, starting at the time of European settlement. So whereas gray wolves, more people are familiar with their story because their extirpation from the United States happened more within recent memory. Whereas with red wolves, it occurred much, much earlier. I guess you could say one of the ideas is that when European settlers came over, they brought their folklore and their myths and their hatred and fear of wolves with them. And when they first encountered wolves in the east of what we now call America, the instinct was to just push them out, kill them, trap them, poison them. And they called them wolves, but they didn't really make a distinction that this was a different animal. Mm-hmm. And we didn't know that until much, much later. The early 1900s actually was when the first biologists started studying them and saying, wait a minute, this is a very different, very distinct canid that we have.
Let's talk about some of the essential differences then in its behaviors and its habits. How is this red wolf different to a gray wolf?
It's actually more in its taxonomy. Its dentition, its cranial structure, its bony structure, it's much more light, built more lightly, what's called gracile, than a gray wolf. Gray wolves are heavier, more robust, larger. You could place it in between a coyote and a gray wolf in terms of the weight scale. So it's a lot of it's the physical appearance of it. In terms of behavior, it is similar in some ways. It lives in extended family units, just like gray wolves do. The packs are normally composed of a breeding female and a breeding male, the offspring from the year before. Mm-hmm. And when those offspring from the year before reach sexual maturity, they disperse, just like you see with gray wolf packs. Now, with gray wolf packs, what you tend to get are even larger extended family units. So the red wolf family units are a bit smaller, if you will. And that might have something to do with energy requirements, you know, just what they prey on. You don't need a pack of 25 wolves to take down one deer, for example, and that's what red wolves will be eating, deer and smaller items. So behaviorally, they are similar in some ways, and ecologically, but they also, in my opinion, tend to be less aggressive than gray wolves. Not that gray wolves are overly aggressive, but I think the red wolves are just a little bit more meek in their nature, more docile.
You mentioned the deer there, but what else forms its diet then?
So they eat white-tailed deer, they eat rabbits, any small mammals that they can really try to get at, raccoons. We have a non-native animal called a nutria here, which is from South America. It's a large rodent, kind of like a beaver-sized animal. They love nutria, which is good because they take care of this non-native animal. Raccoons, they'll eat birds, they'll eat mice. I mean, anything from a deer on down. Deer would probably be the largest that they would take down.
Let's spend a little time then looking at their origins then. Where did they
right.
Where did they come from? How related are they to the grey wolf?
Yeah, this is an excellent question. And I think this question has formed the sticking point for a lot of conservationists not getting behind the red wolf. And they're kind of a redheaded stepchild of the conservation movement, if you will. And I think a lot of it is because of their murky origins. So as I mentioned before, it really wasn't until the early 1900s that biologists began looking at it and making notes that this animal was somehow different than the gray wolf. And it wasn't until, the 60s and 70s that they really started studying them more in depth. And at the time, wildlife genetics was not really, it didn't exist. You know, everybody studied animals based on morphology, the measurements, the physical traits. And then in the 90s, when wildlife genetics came about and was emerging, a study came out saying that, you know, gosh, we looked at the red wolf genetics and we think that it's a hybrid. It originated as a hybrid between coyotes and gray wolves. And this meme kind of stuck. And I think one of the reasons it stuck is because of the physical appearance of the red wolf. It looks like it could be a cross. You know, if you were to take a coyote and a gray wolf and mix them, it looks like what might come out of that. And so then people started wondering, well, if it's a hybrid, why save it? It's not a true species, which is a fair question. But I think that narrative of it originating recently and recent history as a hybrid is probably much too simplistic. I think the answer is much more complicated than that. So since the 90s, we've come a long way with wildlife genetics, and some of the more recent studies indicate that, this gets very complicated very fast, but they indicate that basically there was probably an ancient canid lineage that evolved in North America. And from this ancient lineage, you have this one animal called Canis lepophagus that originated probably in the southwest of the United States. Some of its progenitors crossed the land bridge into Asia. Some of its progenitors stayed in the U.S. So they think of the ones that stayed in the U.S., some of these evolved into Canis latrans, which is what we call the coyote. And of the populations that went into Asia and eventually Eurasia, several different, you know, iterations later, we end up with gray wolves over there, which, as we know, crossed back into North America eventually. But of the lineage that stayed in North America, they think from this coyote lineage that evolved, the red wolf is a splinter off of that. So did it come from coyotes? Probably not, but from the same lineage as coyotes. So it's a much, much more complicated answer than saying it originated as a hybrid probably within the past couple hundred years between coyotes and gray wolves. But I think that more complex answer, that more detailed answer, is probably the more accurate one.
We're going to be talking about, there's a program here in North Carolina, has been for a few years, to reintroduce them into the wild. So did it actually disappear in the wild? How many numbers were left when this program first started?
Yeah, that's a great question. So they actually disappeared in Texas and Louisiana. This was a pretty far-ranging species when it was extant. It probably ranged, if you can picture in your mind a map, it probably ranged from Pennsylvania south to Florida, west to central Texas, and then up as far as southern Illinois. So that's a very large area there. Now, if you think about European settlement patterns, people coming and settling the Atlantic coast and pushing west, what we ended up with was, when red wolves were first starting to be studied, was just a fringe population on the most extreme western part of their former range, and southern, I should say southwestern portion of their range. So in southeastern Texas and southwestern Louisiana, there was this small crescent of land right up against the coast where the last true wild population of red wolves was. And that was studied in the 70s. And it was from that population that the pure, quote, red wolves were taken for the captive breeding program. Now, at the time that this started in the early 70s, different surveys pointed to different numbers of red wolves left in the wild, anywhere from 100 to 300 animals. It took the Fish and Wildlife Service about 4 years of trapping to find these pure animals. And in that 4 years, they pulled about 450 wild canids from the landscape. So I say wild canids because I'm talking about coyotes as well as hybrids. And red wolves had begun to hybridize with coyotes as their population shrank. So it's pretty crazy, but of those 450 animals that they pulled out of the wild, only 17 were found to be pure red wolves. And of those 17, only 14 eventually bred. Three just, you know, didn't breed for whatever reason. So that was the origins of the captive breeding program, and it was very slim ground, you know, to be working with to save an entire species.
Well, let's talk more about the origins of the program. Who started it? Who was the driving force behind getting it going in the first place?
Yeah, that would be the Fish and Wildlife Service. So that's a federal group in the United States under the Department of Interior. And this came, the Red Wolf Captive Breeding Program came on the heels of passage of our Endangered Species Act in 1973, and it was literally a month later that they began trapping these red wolves in the wild, trying to save them. So it had been talked about and had been kind of in the works, I would say, for several years. People, you know, the Fish and Wildlife Service was aware that this species was about to go extinct, but they didn't have the legal groundwork to do anything until the ESA was passed. So they began working on it, I guess you could say as early as the late 60s, but it wasn't until the fall of 1973 that they actually had boots on the ground, people working to save this animal.
Whereabouts were they reintroduced? What's the area? Let's talk a little bit about the area where it actually happened to begin with in the 70s. Where were they introduced?
In the 70s, they were pulling them out of a four-county area in Texas and Louisiana, right on the state line border. Mm-hmm. But then fast forward to 1987, basically they took those 14 animals I spoke about and captive bred them over several generations and eventually had enough surplus that they felt they could spare some and introduce them to the wild. And they chose an area called Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge in eastern North Carolina. And it was chosen for a couple different reasons. They were looking for anywhere, really, within the historic former range that they could reintroduce this animal. But this refuge had just been formed at the time. It had a very low population density, so that was appealing in terms of people. Mm-hmm. So that was appealing. It was a newly designated federal public land, so that was also appealing. And it had the prey, the surveys indicated that it had the prey necessary to support wild wolves, so that was also important as well. And it was really just fortuitous. It was just kind of the stars aligned and the space opened up and it was happened to be good space. So that's how they chose it.
So how large is that area?
The refuge itself, I don't know the acreage off the top of my head. I want to say 60,000 acres, something like that. It's small, you know. When you talk about comparing it to Yellowstone, it's tiny. But I think they always had plans to expand from there. So that was 1987. Now the Red Wolf Recovery Area has grown to encompass a five-county area that's 1.7 million acres. So it's much, much, much larger than when it first started.
Is that all joined together? Is that all in the
it's
same
all contiguous,
part of Easton?
Yeah. Yes, yeah. There's a peninsula on the coast called the Albemarle Peninsula. And if you look at a map of eastern North Carolina, there's like a V of the Outer Banks, and it's the peninsula of land that juts into that V. It's that whole peninsula.
And so that's not all national park anymore?
No, no. And actually, this is a very unique thing about the Red Wolf Program. Whereas most predator reintroductions especially are largely based on public land, the Red Wolf Program is largely based on private land. So in the time since reintroduction, with the land that they've added to it, it's largely cooperative agreements with landowners and that sort of thing. The Red Wolf Recovery Area is now 60% private land and 40% public land. So that's a very unique aspect of the program.
Do we know how far? Because obviously they're tracked. They have you know, radio tracking or whatever. So do we know how far they've roamed? Have any gone further than that distance?
Yeah, that's a good question. Some do leave the peninsula. Not a whole lot of effort is put into tracking them when they do. The program has five Red Wolf biologists with very limited resources. Mm-hmm. If one, I asked them about this too. So if one were to leave the peninsula, basically they would probably see it blipping in and out of their telemetry surveys. They do aerial surveys by plane at least once a week. So they'd probably notice it there one week, not there the next week, there again. You know, they'd know it was kind of crossing in and out of this range. But once it leaves, where do they go to look? You know, it would take a lot of resources for them, flying time, you know, to find that animal. And so if one does disperse, they just kind of let it go. They put it in a category called fate unknown or something like that. So it does happen, but it's not very typical, I would say.
Well, bearing that in mind, then, it must be difficult for them to keep a keep a sort of lid on the numbers. So what's the estimates of how many numbers there are now?
There are, in any given year, between 100 and 130, and the numbers fluctuate. Every year, of course, puppies are born, and every fall you get animals dying and that sort of thing. So it wiggles a little bit, but 100 to 130 is a good estimate right now. It's kind of, the population numbers have plateaued, I would say, in recent years. And that was one of the questions I ask in the book, is why? You know, is it that the habitat is saturated and there's just no more space for red wolves? Is it that they've had problems with illegal killings? Is it that too many are being killed, you know, and that the stable breeding pairs aren't able to maintain their cohesiveness year to year to produce enough offspring to keep it growing? You know, what is the reason? And it's a question I think they don't have a firm answer for yet. I tend to think that there probably is more room on the peninsula for red wolves, but they lose a lot to illegal killing every year, and that's a big problem.
Let's talk about the reaction of the public then, before we get to the illegal killing part, which obviously indicates what direction this next part of the conversation is going to go in. But so initially, back in the early days, what was the, you know, if you tell people we're going to release what you've wiped out, basically, what you would consider to be a scary, dangerous predator onto public land, what was the initial reaction?
Yeah, initially, the first reintroduction site they chose was actually in Kentucky, on the Kentucky-Tennessee border. The land between the lakes is what it was called. And that one failed because of public opposition.
So it didn't get off the ground?
It didn't. And I think the Fish and Wildlife Service learned a lot from that experience. They didn't talk a lot to the locally affected people before they announced the plan. They just kind of announced, we're going to do this. And they happened to do it, announce it for a piece of land where there was already a pre-existing history of animosity towards the federal government because of what the government had done with this land in the past. And so it was, in the eyes of the local people, it was just one more thing where big government was coming in and saying, we're going to use your land for this, you know. And so it didn't go anywhere. It failed. So this second reintroduction site that came up, Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge, I think they were very careful to hold a lot of public meetings before they announced for sure they were going to do this, to kind of test the waters, see what people's concerns were and that sort of thing. And because this was a newly formed National Wildlife Refuge, I think my sense of it, reading some of the historical articles and the surveys, was that people were more concerned about their access, continued access to the land, than they were necessarily about safety. With, you know, what you might think of wolf issues, like, well, are my children going to be attacked? Are my chickens going to be attacked? And that sort of thing. There was a lot of traditional hunting and trapping that took place on this land. And so people were more concerned with, am I still going to be able to hunt deer? Am I still going to be able to trap for fur, you know, once you do this program? And so the Red Wolf program worked with these concerns. Some restrictions were placed on hunting, but not much. It's still used for hunting. It's still used for trapping. Mm-hmm. And so I think people were cautiously optimistic, or they just were kind of tight-lipped about it, you know, but they didn't oppose it to the degree that it would sink it in the beginning. And the Fish and Wildlife Service has worked extremely hard with this program to communicate one-on-one with landowners and concerned groups about maintaining access to the land and that sort of thing. So they've really bent over backwards, I think, to try to make it work in terms of the local attitudes.
So what about public safety? I mean, are these wolves likely to attack people?
Yeah. No, I don't think so. But they took this very seriously, you know, at the time. And because this animal had been largely wiped out before it was studied, you know, there were still a lot of unknowns. You know, would it attack somebody? I think they honestly didn't know. But this was a really interesting historical side note about this program. So a renowned gray wolf biologist, David Meach, worked with the Red Wolf program to develop what's called a recapture collar. And it was basically a very, very large collar that would fit on the wolf that had two syringes of sedative ready to go, you know, pointed at the neck. And it could be detonated, theoretically, remotely, such that if there was a problem where a wolf broke into a house and was threatening somebody, you know, they could detonate this thing remotely, it would discharge a sedative, and the wolf could be knocked out. So they worked on this collar endlessly and tried to get it perfected before reintroducing the wolves. And they did get it to work, but not within the range that they wanted a 3 to 5 mile range, and I think they ended up with like at best a mile or something like that. But they went ahead and released the wolves wearing those collars and the traditional VHF radio telemetry collar. So they were wearing two collars. And then the first time they tried to use it, it didn't work. So they just kind of quietly let the public forget that they had promised that the wolves would have these, you know, recapture collars. But there were two actually with this recapture collar. One, they worked with, I think it was the 3M Corporation, and I think the engineers didn't take into account the salty air because they're right on the coast, and so some of the connections corroded. So that was one problem. Another problem is the habitat that the wolves were in was so thick, and it's still so thick. It's very dense scrub in some areas that it really decreases the signal strength a lot. And so in order to have the range they wanted, it would just require just the battery power was just ridiculous. So that was another problem.
So let's talk about the illegal killing then. That's clearly an issue. So who is it, you know, who is it, hunters? Is it, who is it actually killing
them? I don't know. I wish I knew. So what we do know is that since 2004, on average, 6.5 wolves have died every year. They've had some years that are lighter, some years they've had 9 wolves die. And cumulatively, this is problematic because it's not just a numbers game. You have to look at who's actually dying. And of the wolves that are dying, the majority are breeding wolves. And that's why it's problematic. And there's a lot of questions about this. You know, are people targeting certain wolves? Is it that breeders are just naturally bolder, and so they're more present on the landscape, and somebody's more likely to see them? You know, they're less likely to perhaps run off into the woods. There's a lot of questions about it, but we do know that it's the breeders that are more often dying, and they're dying more in the fall, which is when the hunting seasons are. Mm-hmm. So you've got more people in the woods with guns. You've got more people that might be mistaking them for coyotes, and it's just unclear what the intentions are, if people are targeting them, if it's accidental, if it's a mixture of both. But it is happening, unfortunately. And the issue with the breeders is you want those pairs to remain stable from year to year. Because the red wolves, they don't find a new mate every year. They bond, you know, and will stay with that mate from year to year. So when a breeder is lost, that means that the breeder that's left from that pack then has to raise the pups on their own and or find a new mate. That new mate might kick the pups out earlier than the other parent would have. You know, there's just all sorts of problems that stem from that.
Let's perhaps talk about some of the other issues that might have occurred in attempting to reintroduce what were captive wolves into the wild. So, you know, regardless of the contact with other human beings, how did they first choose the site to introduce them as like a den, or literally just let them go and go off and find their own thing?
They tried. In the beginning, there were specific spots where they released them within the Red Wolf Recovery Area. And what they were looking at was habitat, prey density, that sort of thing. And they had done some experiments on islands prior to doing the initial release within Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge. And what they were testing on the islands was, if you keep a bonded pair of red wolves in a pen for a certain number of months, are they likely to stay? Or will they just have this homing instinct to try to go back to where they came from and just clear out of wherever they were released from? And this was a very important question with the reintroduction, because if you're going to go through all this effort to captive breed wolves for so long to release them, what if they don't stay in that release site, you know? And this had never been done with wolves before in North America, to my knowledge. This was the first time. So they found that if they put a bonded pair of wolves in a pen for 6 months, 6 months in one spot in a pen, that when they opened the door to that pen, the wolves kind of conceived of that area as their territory, and they were more likely to stay. Now, if you were to do it for just a week or two, they were more likely to wander all over the place. So for the initial releases, they had 4 pairs of wolves, so that's 8 wolves total, and they let the first 2 pairs, well, they let one pair go, and then I think it was 2 weeks later they let another pair go, and several months after that they let the third and the fourth pair go. And they found that they did stick largely to the areas where they had had them penned for so long.
And were they able to, how closely were they monitored once they'd actually been released out of the...
Very closely. They monitored them 24 hours a day. I mentioned that they all had two collars on, so they had the recapture collar, which had a VHF frequency as well as the VHF radio telemetry collars. And they had a team of biologists on each pair of wolves 24 hours a day for several weeks before they backed off to just daylight hours. There's a lot of issues with releasing what's called the naive wolves. So these wolves were raised in zoos and mm-hmm. captive breeding facilities, and they were familiar with people. Even though measures are taken within those facilities to limit their interactions with people, there's still issues, of course. And so, for example, when the red wolves were in those what's called acclimation pens for 6 months, when they were trying to get them acclimated to their what they wanted to be their home territories, there were biologists stationed at each of those pens for the whole 6 months, and they fed them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they fed them towards the end before the release wild animals. They would feed them roadkill deer and that sort of thing. Now, one of the biologists had an experience where one morning, as he was bringing the food to the pen, the female approached him, and her body language was basically in wolf language saying, "Let's make friends." And that's not the behavior you want for an animal you're about to release to the wild. So he threw the bucket of food at her and growled at her and, you know, made her scared and made her run away. And it made them realize they might be dealing with some issues when they released these animals. And sure enough, they were. The wolves in the first few months after release were sighted hundreds of times by people. They preferred traveling on the roads instead of in the woods. They would literally lope down the center line of a highway. And when a vehicle came up behind them, they would pull off to the side just like a pedestrian, wait for the car to go, and then get back on the road and start running again. So the program biologists knew that they were going to have some of these behavioral things. The question was, how bad would it be? You know, how much contact with people would there be? What could they do to haze them away from people and that sort of thing? But they knew that they had a pretty good guess that if they could just get to 2 and 3 and 4 generations of wild-born animals, that those wild-born animals would be a lot warier. And they were. Mm. It happened very quickly, fortunately.
So my next question was going to be, so what happened to those 4 pairs? Did they all survive? Did they successfully breed?
Not all of them successfully bred. I think most of them were dead within 2 years, unfortunately. But what was important at the time was that they were staying within the areas where they were supposed to stay. I think some of them bred. I'd have to go back and look at the records to remember exactly what happened. At least one of them, the females died of a uterine infection, you know, just something completely normal like that. So they did continue to do releases for the next, I want to say, 3 or 4 years, but they stopped doing releases from the zoos almost as soon as they felt like they could. Mm-hmm. You know, it was very important to try to get this population up to self-sustaining numbers with the wild-born animals. And with the subsequent releases and efforts, you know, it was not very long at all before the number of wolves in the wild, the proportion of wolves in the wild that were wild-born, outnumbered those that were zoo-born, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
You said there's roughly around 140, we think.
130 at the most, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And that's well, roughly 10 times the ones that were left at the beginning of the program. So that, you know, 10 times is quite significant. But we're talking about 40 years time period. So, I mean, is that considered to be a success?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the 100 to 130 number is for the wild population, and then there's this second population that's the zoo population. There's about 250 in the zoos, so that ups the numbers game a little bit. You have to ask the question, to answer that, you have to ask the question, how do you define success? Is the fact that they're still here successful?
Mm-hmm.
I would argue, yeah. I mean, they were a generation, maybe two, away from extinction, so that's pretty significant. If you define success as having a wild population that's unmanaged, then you would probably say, no, this isn't successful because it's a highly managed program. But in the course of researching and writing this book, I've definitely come to have the opinion that the red wolf will never be unmanaged. It's never going to be a wild population that is unmanaged. Mm-hmm. It's always going to require some level of management. And within that framework, I do think the program has been successful. but I don't think it's realistic to think that it would ever be unmanaged.
I guess what I was thinking of is, does the, you know, the Wildlife and Fisheries Service consider it a success? Have they been able to learn from this? For what I want to go on to talk about really is, what other type of programs are there for releasing? Are there other animals that have been released into the wild in the US? And
right, yeah, I think, I mean, at the of the biologists that I interviewed and worked with over the past 3 years, they do consider it a success. I'm not sure if their program allows them to officially on the record say that,
sure,
or something, you know, but I know that all the biologists feel that it has been a successful program. It still faces challenges going into the future, for sure, but they have figured out management techniques that work, and I think that's the key thing. Most of the challenges that they have to face in the future are of a more of a political sort, dealing with people and our laws for how we want to deal with wildlife and that sort of thing. And then the other problem going into the future is the red wolf still has a propensity to hybridize with coyotes, and now we have coyotes all over the east, even within the red wolf recovery area.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a biological constraint on the program. And again, they have figured out management techniques for minimizing, if not eliminating, that hybridization within the red wolf recovery area, but it takes a lot of effort, and that's why I say it will never be an unmanaged population.
So what about other animals? What other animals have been released into the wild in the US?
Yeah, a lot.
Programs?
A lot. So we have the Mexican gray wolf, which was also very near extinction, also declared functionally extinct in the wild in 1980, the same year the red wolf was. And that was captive bred from even fewer individuals. And so the Mexican gray wolf is a subspecies of gray wolf that historically ranged from southern Mexico up into New Mexico and Arizona. And it is today reintroduced into two national forests that span New Mexico and Arizona. And they have, I want to say, 40 to 50 animals in the wild right now. Their program has faced a lot of issues as well. It's a younger program than the Red Wolf program, though. But their program was largely modeled off of the Red Wolf program. The black-footed ferret is another one that the captive breeding and reintroduction was, you know, a lot of lessons were learned from the Red Wolf program. California condor. I think the gray wolf, even the gray wolf program from Yellowstone, you could argue, had a lot of lessons learned from the Red Wolf program as well.
Okay, so I've been talking to Deline Beeland, whose book, The Secret World of Red Wolves, which looks at the captive breeding program in North Carolina to reintroduce red wolves to the wild, is going to be released in 2013. And we're going to go and look at some wolves now, which is very, very exciting. So, Deline, thank you for talking to Little Atoms today.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Seth Manukin. That was a Little Atoms Road Trip podcast. The show is produced and presented by Neil Denny and was made possible by a traveling fellowship from the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust. Follow the trip on Twitter @LittleAtoms, and thanks for listening.